Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 117 of the Alexi Sale podcast. Just me and the tea man this week, the Talal pot teapot.
Yo.
Yeah, with my crew. I suppose we should concentrate on current affairs. I said a joyous day it was Friday, really. I was doing some filming. I had to get up early and I was got the driver to put on Radio 4 Today program when it started at 6 a.m. And it was just joyful to listen to the news of the
Greens election.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I quickly caught it on the TV just before I left, and it was a wonderful day, really. And on the way back, I listened to the 5 p.m. show on Radio 4 again in the car going back, and it's just, you know, by then they're starting to. You're very excuse, but it feels highly significant, really. That
By 5 p.m. they started to what?
Well, they were kind of, you know, getting in their excuses, and there was more, you know, more centrist pundits being wheeled out to, you know, say various crap. It hints at that. I mean, you can thank your party in a way that I sort of feel like your party awakened this consciousness amongst people. You know, the launch of your party and the 800,000 who registered, you know, their interest, and then, then that dissolved into kind of infighting, and people were left looking for a home, and the Greens were there to offer that. And I think there's it's really potentially, really, I mean, seismic, I think, because it also shows that the people will unite to keep out reform, and they will now unite around the Greens rather than the stinking Labour Party. So, there's a long way to go yet, but and I'm always reluctant to make predictions, but it feels really significant. I mean, I hope to God that the Labour Party is finished, but it was just a joyful day. And then, of course, Saturday, back to less than zero, really. I mean, it's been apparent. I mean, in terms of, you know, the issue that you know concerns us the most, which is, well, because it's a moral bellwether, this issue of Israel. I think it seemed for a long time that the destruction of the apartheid state of Israel is not going to come via military means, or that those military forces that opposed Israel, first of all, the secular forces, the, you know, popular fronts for the liberation and all that, and then the Islamist forces have been, you know, are in retreat or being defeated, really, that the destruction of Israel as an apartheid state is going to come from us, really. It's going to come from the West, and a green government in Britain would go a long way. I mean, and obviously, I mean, support for the Zionist state is also collapsing in the United States. It's difficult to see how that can find, I mean, a majority now, I think, a majority of people in the United States are supportive of the Palestinians and oppose Israel. And that's a stunning change. Now, how they find expression for those views, seen as, I mean, our politics is obviously to a degree bought and paid for by Israel lobby, but that is much more the case with the Democrat Party in the United States. So I don't know how people find expression for that. I mean, Zora Mandami shows that it can be done, but the need, you know, you mean you really need to somehow remove. I mean, I'm not an expert on U.S. politics, but you clearly need to remove those dinosaurs of people like Chuck Schumer Nancy Pelosi and all those terrible, terrible people. I do notice that in The Guardian today, it said that Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, and somebody who is, you know, running to be the presidential candidate for the Democrats, actually referred to Israel as an apartheid state, which is quite a... I think it's slightly caveated, but it's quite a statement coming from a kind of centrist Democrat.
Isn't that a leap from what his usual stance
massive,
is?
Yeah. And I don't know whether he'd try and walk that back or not. But it is. It seems significant, really. And I mean, if
yes, he likened Israel to an apartheid state while he's promoting his memoir.
Yeah.
It breaks my heart because the current leadership in Israel is walking us down that path where I don't think you have a choice about that consideration when thinking about the military partnership with Israel. He said that to say this in America's interest at a time when affordability is at crisis level, you have an administration that literally got elected saying this is exactly opposite of what they would ever consider doing. It's true because Trump, promoted himself as the peacetime president.
I don't know whether he's doing it because, you know, his Israeli backers, Miriam Adelson and the people who've given him hundreds of million dollars are demanding that he go along with the, I can't really speak to Trump's motivation, whether he just, I mean, but it is clear that Israel is winning militarily, but one can see that in its greatest moment of triumph, maybe also be its greatest moment of defeat, really. I think people, I imagine the average person is appalled by the, you know, torpedo in the warship in international waters, for instance.
Mm.
Yeah, the destruction of the expansionist aims in southern Lebanon and the bombing of Tehran, really, is that all really, I mean, leads, you know, any right-minded person to be, you know, even if they're not politically engaged, is just repelled by these actions. And we can only maybe hope that in that moment of greatest triumph is also their moment of greatest defeat.
But isn't it historically that wartime is what makes people just kind of support whoever's in charge or like rally behind their government?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think this is exceptional. I know Linda said there was an article in Haaretz yesterday saying that the young people in Israel are even more right-wing and reactionary and, you know, ethno-fascist than the older generation, if that is possible. And that is a dispiriting, you know. But, I mean, it's a deliberate policy, obviously, of the right of Netanyahu to keep Israel in a state of permanent war and therefore to ensure support for them, really. I think it's less true in the United States because it isn't as, or you know, that I don't know. I mean, militarism is I mean, the United States is not at risk. You know, the United States is doing this out of choice, and it's a long way away. And I think people don't feel that. But polls show. The people have not, the fact that the United States is bombing Iran has not led to an upsurge of patriotism. In fact, it's led to the reverse, really.
It feels more like a Vietnam than a Iraq this time. Yeah. They don't have like this 9/11 to hang their reasoning on.
And they're also, as you know, Gavin Newsom points out, really, that they're also... you know, every $500,000 missile is money that's coming out of their health budget, life expectancy is plummeting in the United States. The average Chinese person now lives 20 years longer than the average person in the US. The infrastructure, I imagine, as people tell me, I haven't been there for years, but People tell me you see a lot of really crumbling infrastructure. And again, this is all money that is being spent to aid Israel and in its apartheid ethnic cleansing ambitions. You know, these millions and millions of dollars, billions, trillions of dollars being expended, money that is clearly coming out of social care and infrastructure in the United States to bolster the aims of this insane ethno-fascist state in the Middle East. And I think that, again, the neutral or the right-thinking person in the United States would see this really and really want to do something about it. So it's...
At the beginning, you know, I was hearing a lot of people saying that this was all just a distraction from the Epstein, you know, malarkey.
Yeah.
How much of that do you think is actually behind it?
I don't know. I mean, it's possible. I think I don't know how much trouble he's in with that. He just kind of denies it and sidesteps it. I don't know. I mean, it's certainly a possibility that this is all that this is all being done, or is partly being done to divert from
maybe
Epstein.
Partly. Yeah.
It
seems a lot more thought out now that you consider that. You know, they secured the Venezuelan oil in time to start this war in the Middle East. Do you think maybe they were even thinking about it from back then? I wonder.
Sometimes an easy win, you know, like the West had an easy win in Kosovo and in against the Serbs, and then in Liberia, and that led them into the morale, thinking that they would have an easy win in Iraq, which turned out in a sense not to be the case. So I honestly don't know enough about U.S. politics.
My instinct says it's all roads lead to Israel, really, because like Iran was the last kind of anti-Israel stronghold in the Middle East. All the other Arab countries had kowtowed and
yes, they've taken
paid their
Syria
ties
and
done
Libya
their deals with Israel, normalized relations, and Iran were the only one. But what I hate seeing is this kind of rallying behind the Islamic Republic as if they're some heroes, as if Hezbollah are these heroes.
I know. I mean, we should remind ourselves that, of course, when the Islamic revolution in 1979 was achieved in association with the substantial communist and socialist forces in Iran, and then once the Shah had been deposed, Khomeini then turned on the left and either murdered, imprisoned, or drove into exile those forces, and instead brought in a hardline theocratic regime. So we shouldn't be. Sometimes. I mean, I understand the impulse in a way. I'm not,
Well, Palestine is such an issue that drives, that people's passion drives them behind supporting Palestine. And sometimes they're blindsided. They just see anyone supporting Palestine and think they're automatically a good guy. And really, in this situation, none of the players are good guys apart from the civilians on the ground who are the ones getting bombed, you know. So, it's a really tricky one.
The Islamic theocracy and the Revolutionary Guard Corps and the besieged militia, they're not good people. You know, they are people who have been oppressing their own. It's just, but I do understand that impulse to want to.
Of course.
You know, because you see anybody you oppose is the United States and opposes Israel, and you kind of want to, you feel sympathetic towards them. But yes, it's certainly blanket support for.
Just think more carefully before you throw all your support behind someone. You can oppose, it's more than one thing can be true, you know? This war is unjust and this war is illegal and Trump and Israel aren't acting on the behalf of humanity in starting this war. They've got their own fucking interests, but Iranian Khomeini should not be the leader, and it's But now he's just been replaced by his identical son, which is quite weird to see how copy paste he seems. Like, they're not good guys either. What really fucking winds me up is that, you know, when you can't help, after these 2.5 years we've been through, when you see those bombs falling in Tel Aviv, a part of you is kind of like fist pumping the air.
Yes.
And then I just catch myself in that brief moment where I feel kind of passionate, like I'm happy to see a place being bombed.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, look what they've made me. Like, I'm angry at them for making me enjoy the sight of this. Like, how fucking far have they pushed me? Where I'd never in my life feel like the sight of a bomb hitting a city is something to celebrate or be happy about. And even if a fraction of me is celebrating the sight of it, it's a horrible feeling.
Look what they've turned us into. I know it's true.
How dare they make me celebrate that?
Their
cruelty, you know, I hope that the cruelty of Israel doesn't get forgotten in all of this over the last 2 years.
No, well, they kind of seem triumphant, but like I say, we'll see, really. I don't know. I don't know where this ends. I mean, it's interesting, developments that supposedly that the Israelis and the United States are organizing an incursion by the Kurds in the north, I think.
Oh, yes, from Iraq, coming in from Iraq.
Yeah. I think the Kurds are obviously aware that, you know, what a two-faced ally that Rojava would have shown them that. The United States is not necessarily an ally, that it's a very capricious ally and will drop them in. Well, in fact, you know, I mean, George W. Bush in Iraq I urged the Kurds and the Marsh Arabs to rise up, and then they were then slaughtered by the forces of Saddam Hussein. So I'm sure the Kurds understand that. I don't know which brand of Kurdish fighters it is who are being encouraged to attack. I don't know whether it's our guys in the PKK or whether it's some more right wing Kurdish factions. Maybe an expert can. So we know many experts of, you know, geopolitics, that this is podcast is their first listening on a Saturday morning. The Chatham House and the various, the CIA, you know, the intelligence services, and that they eagerly download our podcast and analyze it for the insights that it brings. And so, if one of those wants to, even anonymously, if one of those wants to contact us with further information about that, we would be delighted to hear it.
Well, they seem to be perhaps the Democratic Party of Iranian Kurdistan.
Right.
Between 25 and 35 million Kurds inhabit a mountainous region straddling the borders of Turkey, Iraq, Syria, Iran, and Armenia. That's a lot more than I thought.
Yeah.
And in the last, well, just today, Iran has been intensifying attacks on the region.
There's a mind fuck there, where, you know, who'd you support in that scenario, really? That obviously the Kurds are being used as a tool of US and Israeli imperialism, but
But they have a reason to be so bitter and vengeful, because they have suffered decades of discrimination and repression. You know, the Kurds have been wanting independence for a long, long,
from
long,
literally
long,
everybody.
Long, long.
Yes, I mean, not just from Iran. I don't know how they were treated in Iran, but obviously from Turkey. And
so I wonder. Yeah, Trump maybe promised them their own little state.
I wonder whether they're followers of, whether they're followers of Ocalan, in which case we would support them, or whether they're some more centrist or right wing Kurdish fighters. Again, anybody, you know, I know that this podcast is eagerly downloaded on a Saturday morning in all the major capitals of the world and in all the revolutionary bases that the people in Rojava on a Saturday morning gather around their laptops to listen, and in the free areas of Myanmar on a Saturday morning, it's obligatory, really.
On their wind-up radios. Podcast.
Yes, that's one of the things. I felt a bit guilty there. I was just reaching for something. I was reprimanded by a listener. I was trying. You and Anthony Etam and Nick were just talking seriously. I just wanted to inject a piece of stupidity into the discourse there. So I was just had that bit about the wind-up radio in my mind, and it didn't really work. And I apologize, yes, to the memory of Sir Trevor Bayliss. I'm sure that you could listen to it over the clockwork. Didn't really make a noise. And it was just an entirely maladroit intervention on my part.
Over-explain. Yeah. That's the listener taking a bit too seriously.
I want to walk it back. Really, I'm sure the Clockwork Radio was there.
Yes, he was saying actually the Clockwork Radio liberated the accessibility for world media for a lot of.
Maybe you could have a Clockwork laptop. I don't know how technically.
I remember around a similar time, there was an equivalent thing for a laptop. I think Bill Gates pioneered, and I could be wrong there, maybe it wasn't Bill Gates, but there was this kind of like really cheap laptop that like did the fucking job, and they made millions of them and gave them to school kids all around Africa.
That wasn't like the Raspberry, that one, was it?
No, it was just a nice little plastic thing with a screen. Raspberry, I think, doesn't have a screen. That's just the computer bit that you can attach to stuff.
And
I think it was the laptop equivalent of the wind-up radio, but you had to plug it in.
Yeah,
I think it had a chargeable battery in it.
Right. Well, I'd be interested to know what's happened to that. I know that this podcast is on a Saturday morning. The major technical institutions, MIT in the United States, Boston, that on a Saturday morning, people gather around and download this podcast. The first thing they do on a Saturday morning. Even with the time difference. And so if anybody there in the Science Institute in Moscow or Beijing who listen to this podcast first thing they do on a Saturday morning, if they want to get in touch and let us know what the state of play is with the wind-up Clockwork laptop, I'd be eager to know. And like a Clockwork Radio, I have now wound down. That got me through about, 15 minutes, a bit more. And I'm kind of like a Clockwork soldier in a ballet, the Bolshoi Ballet.
Maybe it wasn't Bill Gates. I just found an article of Bill Gates saying the laptop for the poor is a joke, and he was mocking the $100 laptop.
Really? Yeah.
One laptop per child foundation. The $100 laptop is the iconic Exo laptop founded by Nicholas Negroponte of the MIT Media Lab in 2005, designed for education in developing nations. It was a rugged, low-power device intended for children. Yeah, it's got a simple black and white screen. You could do all your homework on it. And it was rugged, like you could throw it at a rock and it would survive.
Right.
Yeah, one laptop per child.
Bill Gates probably sabotaged it.
Bill Gates hated it. He was roasting it. What an asshole.
Yeah, well, you get no argument from me about that. Yeah. Bill Gates. Bloody Bill Gates.
Oh, my God. Guess what?
What?
There was a second generation prototype, and it had a crank on it that touched.
Oh, it was Clockwork,
but it proved unviable.
Yeah.
One laptop per child.
Bill Gates didn't want that. He just wanted to his intellectual property So anyway, that's the world situation. Have we covered that, or we could go back? I would say it was very exciting, the Greens and Zach Polanski and now Jeremy.
Yeah, they were very quick to blame the Greens' victory on like sectarianism and even race stuff. Like, what were they? It seems so long ago now.
Family voting,
yes. Pushing your grandma into the booth and saying,
yeah.
Vote Greens, you motherfucker, or else no tuna sandwich for you later.
Sly in the family stone voting.
Yeah, and like husbands, oppressive Muslim forcing their wives under indentured servitude, these arranged marriage wives forcing them to vote for Greens.
Yeah, and it didn't really stick. Well, like, I mean, that's one of the, it's like, you know, the accusations of, yeah, you know, they try and stick Zach Polanski with the old anti-Semitism accusations that they made against Jeremy, and they really don't stick at all. I think no, everybody's wise to that.
Yeah, and of course the police said that's called voter fraud. Two people aren't allowed in a booth. Yeah. If that's ever seen, it's reported to the police.
Yeah.
We didn't see any of that happen.
No.
It's funny. And a gay Jewish man is now the leader of the Islamist Sharia population.
Yeah. I think it is shaping up to be an interesting landscape, because, I mean, there is not only the Greens, there is also whatever now your party is, you know, I mean, we'll see what happens with that, whether it, you know. But I think that whole surge, you know, from the launch of your party is also that there are really interesting experiments in kind of local. I mean, obviously, I know London more, that in Hackney, the Hackney Independent Socialists, and here in Camden with Andrew Feinstein and the Camden People's Alliance, that these are really interesting experiments in, you know, finding a kind of politics which is rooted in the local community. And I know these were proto branches of your party, but I think they have decided to stay away from that and just be local parties. And in doing that, whether consciously or unconsciously, they seem to be, you know, echoing a lot of the ideas of Ocalan and of Murray Bookchin and this kind of localized kind of hyper democracy, you know. And I think there's a really, you know, in tandem with the Greens,
I think
there can be some really exciting.
They could really work together very well. Yeah. I think that your party is, you know, as a member, and I've seen what the emails I get and what the forums and the website say. It's like they almost like their attention has gone away from winning elections, and it's more about the local issues. And
they, who are we talking about now?
Your party.
All right.
They seem to be sating their election bug by holding all these internal elections. Like, I voted for different leaders of different factions and councils and boards and all that. So you're voting for all these different people, but it's actually just internal your party elections.
Yeah.
And they seem to be focusing on just getting councillors out there, organising, doing local events and setting up local groups and activism. And then in the Gorton and Denton election, they fucking said, go vote for Greens. And they told us to go vote for Greens. So, like, do they even want to win an election now? I'm not sure.
Well, I think there are areas, I imagine, where they are strong, or, you know, areas where they prove to be strong.
And then they'll stand in those areas.
And they'll stand, and the Greens will.
And, you know, Reform are so clever at making you scared of them and think they're serious. But now I'm like, every time there's a big Reform protest or march, or it's just the same 20 blokes from different parts of the country. You know, they got thrashed pretty heartily.
Oh, such an odious character there, Matthew Goodwin. Ugh.
Yeah, he's gross. And so maybe their support isn't as widespread as we thought. Maybe I'm being optimistic.
They gather
and meet. But they're coming from different constituencies and meeting up and putting on a strong face. But in their own places, people don't want them running their neighborhood.
No, well, I think that, I mean, they are strong, but the anti-reform coalition is stronger. And as long as it coalesces around the Greens or independent socialists rather than the stinking Labour Party, then, you know, that's a really positive development, I think. Very exciting, you know, and from that, you know, I mean, both in terms of domestic issues, but also obviously in terms of Palestine, that is the way that Israel will be, the apartheid, the Zionist state of Israel will be ended, is by, it will come, seeing as it's a creation of the West, you know, it's a European, should we say, European solution to a European problem.
Mm.
It will be, its demise will come, is more likely, I think, to come from, you know, the West than from military, you know, either from those corrupted, in their many, several different ways, the corrupted regimes in the Middle East, I don't know, but yeah.
I saw a funny meme of some like Reform or Britain First people on a cliff top with binoculars looking at a migrant boat, small boat. And he says, "Oh, it looks like it's some refugees from Dubai." And then he looks through the binoculars and it's just a bunch of like bikini models.
yeah.
On the boat.
I mean, that has been a sort of, I mean, you know, Schadenfreude and all that, but there's all those fucking influencers, and the right way, Isabel Oakeshott and that, who all moved to Dubai.
They're like, "What? This now shouldn't be happening here?" Or something like that, they're saying.
Yeah. It's you.
Where did you think you were going?
Yeah.
It's not just a place on your phone screen. It's a Gulf state.
It's a Gulf state that has slavery as part of its
slavery and supports economic. Israel. And
yeah. Economic system. So yes, that has been a, you know, taking.
Here's what I will say though about Dubai and Abu Dhabi. It's also been the refuge for a lot of refugees.
Yeah.
Including a lot of my family have found a home and built their families.
Yeah.
And they become part of the middle class in those areas.
Yeah.
It tends to be the expats, immigrants who, you know, the white immigrants who go and get the upper class jobs.
Yeah.
The property, the finance, and they don't pay taxes and they fucking live a life of absolute luxury. Whereas my cousins and aunties and uncles and second cousins and fucking third cousins, I've got a ridiculous family. And they're all the ones out there.
You've got all my cousins, haven't you? Because you've got like 63 cousins and I've got
68.
Well, I have, but I don't know who the hell they are.
Yeah, I've got 68 first cousins. Yeah.
68 first cousins.
They're all doing like the admin jobs.
Yeah.
Data inputting, teachers, you know, managers of shops. You know, that's what my cousins out there are doing. So there is a middle class out there, or even a working class, you know, for sure. And a lot of them were refugees from Syria, from Lebanon. And I worry for them.
Yeah. You know,
because there is some domestic buildings being struck out there. In fact, I have cousins who are just in London and they live in Dubai. So they went home and they're from Lebanon. So they went home via Lebanon to visit their family. And then they're about to fly home to Dubai. And then this war starts and Dubai starts getting bombed and all the flights get canceled. So, and I was messaging going, "I hope you're okay." Cause I thought they were in Dubai. Hope you guys are all right.
We're fine and safe. We're in the Lebanon.
Yeah. They said, don't worry about us. Fine, we're in Beirut. We're staying in Beirut for a while. I was like, okay.
We're in the southern suburbs of Beirut.
And then the next day they are.
Really?
They were near the bombs. Like, they were at the end of their street.
Fuck.
The next day I see this and I'm like, fuck, they just told me, don't worry, I'm in Lebanon. And next thing I know, they're on a flight back to London. Like, you know, I think when people come back, hang out in London for a bit. So, you know, there are as much catharsis as you're getting from seeing, you know, deserving countries being struck finally, you know, who thought they were immune to this stuff. there are in the always with war, there's civilians caught in the middle, man, and their victims. Lives are being thrown upside down.
Yeah, yeah,
it's wild.
I agree. We haven't done a film club for a while, have we? We sort of let that drop. Nobody seemed that upset, really.
No. No one seemed maybe upset.
Maybe we should think about reviving that.
Well, we have got a new series on our Patreon called Alexi Reacts.
Oh, yeah, that's what we did, yeah.
That's on there now, episode one of Alexi Reacts, which I realised was our pilot episode.
Yeah.
It's on our Patreon, it's Alexi reacting to Puppet Pilot for our pilot episode, a sketch from the all new
Alexi Sasha, yeah.
And it's a very, very funny sketch.
Yeah.
And Alexi and me watch it and react.
If that doesn't make you want to become a Patreon subscriber, I don't know what will, really.
It's really nice. It's like 15 minutes long. And we're going to do it every week, hopefully. Well, that's the plan. Please send us your suggestions of what Alexi should react to, alexiselpodcast@gmail.com, or message me on patreon.com/alexiselpodcast. And if you go to patreon.com/alexiselpodcast, you can support the show and gain access to exclusive content such as Alexi Reacts and full video podcast episodes, Alexi shooting guns. And
feels like a long time ago.
Alexi, Lisa, and Nigel watching The Young Ones. But Alexi reacts every week on Patreon.
I'm going to have to do that this week.
Yeah, but we don't have to do it today. I know you've got to rush off after this. We could do it on Monday or Tuesday.
Lunch with the...
Let's record one on Tuesday.
All right.
I'm going to try and put them out every Wednesday on the Patreon.
Okay.
What should Alexi react to next? Thank you for the plug time. And what did that remind me of? I'd love to hear Alexi's views on whether he thinks there will be a United Ireland. Toby asks on the Patreon chat.
I would have thought so. Eventually. I don't know. It's still... I don't know. My knowledge of Irish politics is lamentably... I mean, Ireland seems to be... comes and goes, but you know, it's obviously reacting better than Britain to Zionism and US imperialism. And I don't know what the factors in play are there.
I think, is religion still a very strong divider in Israel, Ireland?
I guess that's true.
Is it enough to what? Yeah, I guess. There's a contingency in Northern Ireland who love being British, isn't there?
Well, there's a lot of this, yeah, the Protestants, yeah. Yeah. And also, of course, the fanatical supporters of Israel.
Oh.
If you go around the loyalist areas of, you know, if you go around the Republican areas of Belfast, you'll see, you know, Palestinian flag. And similarly in the loyalist areas, you'll see the Israeli flag.
Sometimes on two sides of the same street, isn't it?
Yeah, which is, again, I think the loyalists are on the losing side on that one, really. It was funny doing Strangers on a Train in Northern Ireland, really. We went from Belfast to Derry/Londonderry. And, you know, kind of had to be aware of the, a lot of people seem to have government jobs. Some of them, I think, in security, the people I mentioned that you couldn't really talk in detail about what they did. But also, you know, you're aware that some of them had loyalist sympathies. It wasn't my remit on that particular show to dig into that, really. But, it was a weird experience.
Avil or Avi on the Patreon asks, this is a shallow question, but I'll ask it all the same. Has Alexi done an episode, or would he consider doing an episode on comic strip The Strike? My son Sid and me watch it every year together, quote the arse off of it far too often, and it's in their top five things to watch ever. Favorite character is Alexi in it. One of the most sublime pieces of comedy acting. Maybe we'll do an Alexi Reacts about it.
Sure, yeah. Well, Peter Richardson, you know, the moving spirit behind the comic strip, he does these events where he shows like things like the strike and stuff, and then we talk about it afterwards, really. And in fact, I'm doing, I think, a little clump of four in Bridport, Dartmouth, Saltcombe, and Walthamstow, I think, in, I don't know when, April or May. And so people should come along to those.
Avi, if you're in one of those areas.
Come along and listen. I don't know whether he'll be showing. He shows. He likes, Peter particularly likes one that was only shown on TV once called Red Nose of Course, which is actually very good, about John Major, the former Conservative leader, Prime Minister, whose father was in the circus. And so it's a kind of strike style fantasy where I play John Major, is working both as a clown and as the leader of the Conservative government, and I play his father.
Right.
I take my top off a few times. I was thinner then.
Oh my gosh.
He sometimes shows that, sometimes shows Strike, sometimes shows Supergrass. But yeah, I'd be happy to do a, I'm happy to talk. You know, I always feel, I think it must be dispiriting if you're some sort of 80s band and you're only outlet is that kind of rewind circuit where you you play your hits to people who are now getting close to being pensioners and men, balding men who wear funny little hats to hide their baldness. But I feel that because I am also still an artist whose current work, like this podcast, which is listened to on a Saturday morning in all the capitals of the world, really.
Yeah, illegally downloaded. First thing they listen
to in the embassies and the foreign ministries is. So I feel that because I am, I don't mind doing nostalgia stuff because I also feel that I'm somebody who remains relevant. So in the modern world,
hey man, Martin Kemp's makes his bread and butter these days DJing 80s parties to
really
to like old ladies in Benidorm. It's nothing, no shame, man.
Well, I think some shame, but
have you heard, when a person has a one hit wonder,
for example
Rick Astley or yourself or what's the I am the one and only geezer called
Chesney Hawks.
There's like this cycle that seems to be unanimous amongst them, is where you blow up, your song blows up, you become famous, you tour, your song is everything, it's everywhere, it's making you lots of money, and then nothing else you do seems to hit in the same way and resonate with people. You start to resent that song or that hit or that TV show or whatever, you start to resent it. You get angry, you start doing shows refusing to sing it, where that's what everyone is coming to see.
The new material, yeah.
And you start getting angry with people who ask you to play it or sing it or do it. And then you get shunned and rejected. You feel bitter until the day comes when you realize, wait a second, I've bought this house, I've sent my kids to a nice school, university, I've got a nice car, and it is because of that song. And you start to appreciate once again that song that brought you all this comfort in your life, and then you spend that's the point where you spend the rest of your life going on tour singing that song as many times as people want with a brand new appreciation for it. Where are you on that cycle? But there must be something relatable there with the comic strip stuff
I'm happy to take part in those events.
What was the strike about?
The strike, I mean, it's particularly brilliant. I mean, it won the Golden Rose. It won a lot of awards that year, and it is I mean, certainly it's the peak of the comic strip as an ensemble on TV. So I play a scriptwriter who's from South Wales, who writes a script about the miners' strike of 1984. The script is then bought by, and there's a lot of parodies there of like characters who are now forgotten, like David Putnam, and Keith plays a kind of David Putnam character. So that script is then bought by Hollywood, and the film is then remade as with starring Al Pacino, played by Peter, Meryl Streep, played by Jennifer, as a kind of, and it's about the crassness of Hollywood. It's about so it works on several different levels. So you've got the story in the real world, as it were, of me as the scriptwriter. And one of the things I do in that film is that I underplay that everybody else is going so big with, quite rightly, with their characterizations, that I pulled my performance back. So it's quite a very quiet, centered performance as Paul, the writer. And so you've got the Paul's reality of writing this script for Al Pacino. And then you've got the movie itself, which is this huge, lavish kind of sentimental starring Arthur Scargill, played by Al Pacino. So it kind of ends with Paul disillusionedly going back to South Wales and throwing his typewriter, as it was then, up in the air. Disgust. So it's a film that works on it's a really excellent piece, and we're all in it. Everybody's in it, really, which I think is nice as well.
But you're taking a central kind of lead role in this.
Yeah, for once. Yeah. I'm the kind of spine. I'm the core. I mean, yeah, as the writer of the film, The Strike, I'm the core of it. But kind of everybody's in it. Everybody else plays multiple roles. I only play Paul, the writer. But, as I say, the whole gang are there. Rick, Dawn, Jennifer. Everybody,
Al Pacino, as Peter Richardson, as Al Pacino, as Arthur Scargill.
Yeah.
So many, like, multi-layered and film within a film.
And it's very, it was nice. I mean, it was fun filming it again because the whole gang was involved, you know.
Maybe I'll put together a highlight reel and we can do an Alexi Reacts to The Strike.
Sure.
I see a video as well of Eddie Izzard talking about it with Peter.
All right.
The BFI.
Nobody told me about that.
It was back in 2023. Well, there you go, Avi. There's a bit of Strike for you. And at some point, keep an eye out on Alexi Reacts. We'll talk about The Strike some more. Okay. About 10 minutes ago, I said, oh shit. And then I never followed up with that.
Oh, yeah.
Confusing listeners at home. They've remade The Bride, Alexi.
I don't think it's really a straight remake of what year was it? Me and Sting and Jennifer Beals. I don't think it's a, is it a remake of the it was based on a novel by, I think it was based on a novel by somebody or other.
Well, yours was in 1985.
85, okay.
Which I still haven't seen. I want to watch it with you.
Oh, yeah, well, we could.
I think I want to do a commentary track with you about it.
Yeah, sure. It is quite poor.
We could watch it together. Okay, so The Bride 2026 is an American gothic romance film. Written and directed by Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, we like her.
I really like her. Why do you like her?
I don't know. I feel like she's one of us, but I might be mistaken about that.
She gives off that vibe, doesn't she? I think she's wonderful. And she's written and directed this. Starring Jesse Buckley and Christian Bale.
I don't know if it has any...
That's what I'm trying to get to.
Any,
the film draws inspiration from The 1935 film Bride of Frankenstein.
James Whale film, yeah.
Which is based on Mary Shelley's 1818 novel, Frankenstein. Yeah. So no mention of, what's the book yours?
I don't know if there was a book. I can't remember now. The 1985 movie with Sting and Jennifer Beale.
And it's set in 1930s Chicago.
Okay.
The Frankenstein's monster asks Dr. Euphronius to create a companion for him. Together, they give life to a murdered woman known as the Bride, sparking romance, police interest, and radical social change. I want to see who. What was the name of your character in the circus?
Oh, Magar. I'm sure he doesn't reappear in. Because there's a separate storyline about the Frankenstein's monster, the male monster, escaping and joining a circus. I don't think that. I doubt that they will have pursued that storyline in the.
And you say Omega?
No, Magar.
Magar.
M-A-G-A-R, I think.
I'm not seeing any Magars. It seems to be they get involved with the mob, the Chicago mob, in this, as opposed to the circus.
Yeah, no, I think it probably owes very little to the.
Oh, that's a shame.
Frank Rodham iteration of the Bride.
All right, I'm going to keep an eye on this Bride business.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they might owe you money, Lex, and I want to make sure you get
probably.
It.
Probably. Everybody does. Everybody owes me money.
Okay.
I think I'm going to go now, unless we've got anything else for this week.
No, I think that'll do, mate. I think that'll do.
Okay. Well, it's been quite a week. It's been a bloody rollercoaster week of emotion and elation followed by despair, really. Just, what have they done now, really?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the genocide in Gaza is continuing. I think they've stopped. They're not letting any food get in.
Oh, yeah, immediately they closed those crossings.
Monsters. Unbelievable monsters.
Yeah. And those schoolgirls were the first victims in Iran.
Yeah, yeah.
What a way to start, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they're getting good at killing children now, the Israelis. But at least a lot of people are seeing the true reality of that. Murderous, monstrous regime. So, you know, take hope where you can, people. Cling to each other. Maybe have some fruit.
Mm.
Kimchi for gut health. It's amazing how people can, you know, take something. Some humans' abilities and be a dick about it. Which is sort of like Lime bikes. Yeah. You know, as a lifelong cyclist, the Lime bike user can be, you know, presents, it's kind of problematic, really. You know, it's the way some people behave on Lime bikes. Also, I think it seems like twice this week I have stopped at a zebra crossing for an old person to cross in front of me. And they've still shouted at me because I think they're so frightened now because of bikes whizzing past them and not stopping. But they just sort of yell at anybody. And I stopped. I'm like, I fucking stopped for you. Why are you shouting at me? And coming down from Hampstead Heath last week, going south down, I think it's Highgate West Hill, a woman who I stopped for. A woman on stick shouted at me, "You're an old man. You should know better."
Jeez.
Which is, I don't fucking know. Stop. No, I haven't run you down. I've stopped. What are you yelling at
me
for?
Maybe she was talking about something else.
No, she was shouting at me.
No, I know. Because, is that you? Well, maybe she knows something.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. But that sort of that ranks alongside Santa Claus faced old motherfucker as a thing of being shouted. You're an old man and you should know better. Sounds like Michael Caine, doesn't it? You're an old man and you should know better. You're a big man, but you're out of shape. I do this for a living.
You're an old man.
You're an old man.
You should know better.
So that's going to be my calling card. Now that's going to be my nom de guerre, as it were, or my 80s nostalgia parties catered for. I'll come and do in the tight suit and go, hello, John, got a new motor. And my epithet will be, I'm an old man and I should know better. So with that, I will say goodbye, dear listeners across the world, and I'll see you, well, this Saturday morning and next Saturday morning and every Saturday morning, unless we can't be bothered. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L Podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.